Is it really interesting to see how these companies are approaching Chicago, right?
She was telling me she's really trying to understand how the tech ecosystem here works.
What's interesting about the baby boomers is that they've never met a debt they didn't like.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Hello, friends, and a happy Monday afternoon. 12:12 on this kind of dreary, at least downtown, Monday. It's supposed to clear out later. You heard Don Kleppen talking about the pharmaceutical bankruptcy of Purdue. We're going to be talking with the Washington Post in just a little bit. Steve Bertrand is out traveling the globe as usual. John Hanson here filling in for most of this week. You can also catch me on the Jam weekday mornings on CW26. But jumping right into things, as you guys often do on a Monday morning, Jim Dahlke and Catherine Davis from Chicago. And, oh, guys, thanks for stopping on by today.
Hey, John.
Hey, great to be here.
Still coming in even when it's the B team up here at the host booth. I always appreciate that. Let's jump right in. News from Amazon. Got some new jobs coming to Chicago.
That's right. Yeah. You know, Amazon HQ2 may be pretty far in the rearview mirror for Chicago, but the company is still going to be bringing hundreds of tech jobs to Chicago. So Amazon just announced today that they're going to add about 400 new tech jobs to its corporate office here in downtown. It's going to about double its workforce here currently for its corporate office. And so these are not exactly the 20,000 or so tech jobs that an HQ2 could have provided, but still Chicago kind of reaping the rewards of Amazon kind of making that decision to pull out of New York City, now sort of dispersing those tech jobs amongst its more than a dozen local tech hubs around the country.
Yeah, you say 400 jobs, and that doesn't sound like a lot to me, but then you say it doubles the workforce. I imagine perhaps the plan is that there'll be more behind, too, at some point.
That's right. Yeah, Amazon Web Services has a big presence here in Chicago. That makes up a pretty significant chunk of its local office. And yeah, I mean, you know, these are an indication how these kind of coastal tech giants are sort of viewing the city, right? We've seen numerous announcements of kind of big tech companies kind of increasing their presence here. And, you know, 400 jobs is still 400 tech jobs, right?
Oh, heck yeah. And I imagine that people out there, if you're listening, you're looking for a job. How are they advertising these gigs? I hear they're having a career day, right?
That's right. So there's a career day, you know, happening.
Oh, tomorrow.
Yeah, just tomorrow. And it's part of, you know, it's happening here in Chicago, but also in several other cities as part of an initiative to add 30,000 jobs across the country. So they're really getting the word out, trying to recruit people that are right for these tech jobs.
That's cool stuff. All right, let's talk about Sheer Circle, because I know someone who goes to a small salon in the West Ukrainian village, I just recently was able to start doing mobile scheduling your appointments. Yeah. And I thought, you know, this has got to be a big undertaking for a small salon to do. And here comes Sheer Circle, a new startup here in Chicago.
That's right. So they're actually based out in Bloomingdale. Mm-hmm. But basically what they do is they've created a platform that allows salons, spas, fitness centers, as well as independent workers in those verticals. So, you know, your independent barber, independent massage therapist, to use this platform for their clients to book and pay for services. Mm-hmm. So really streamlining, you know, how the salons are getting new clients and operating their business, you know, and also bringing the mom and pop salon into the 21st century and kind of giving them the tech to do online booking, right?
Right, without having to build their own websites from scratch, undertakings that they can't do. There's other places that do this where they create an experience for, you know, small businesses to have an online booking system or some sort of payment system. But I imagine is these are people that know the salon business specifically, and there's different unique things with every business about what they want on that online platform. So I imagine they're really diving into the salon experience.
Exactly. Like salon owners can manage the staff schedules. They can track performance statistics, you know, kind of keep track of their clients, you know, and who's due for a haircut when, things like that.
Oh, well, right. Wait, do you take a picture of yourself and it judges you accordingly? That'd be really good. Okay, I teased this earlier. McDonald's, and by the way, I want everyone to join the conversation on the text line, 312-981-7200. Would you want to talk to a robot in the drive-thru? Well, it may not be too far away, Jim, right?
That's right. So just last week, McDonald's acquired a startup called Apprente. And so basically what they've created is sort of a voice-based ordering platforms for organizations like McDonald's. So basically, McDonald's can think about this in terms of, you know, speeding up the delivery line, making the process a little more streamlined, and yeah, kind of refocusing kind of the person in that role for a different, you know, kind of higher level responsibility, and kind of using a robot to kind of fill that role. So a lot of interesting things about this, but clearly the drive-through experience is going to start to look pretty different before too long.
I imagine so many people out there are rolling their eyes or shaking their heads. Do they have any idea how good these robots are at taking our orders?
So there's actually a startup in Chicago called Encounter AI, and I interviewed them a little while ago, and you know, they're working on the same sort of voice technology, and you know, their drive-through ordering system says it's about 85% accurate, which is pretty good. And
it doesn't sound great, though.
They say that's actually better than what the percentage is when a human is in there. The biggest hang-ups for them and during our interview was that once you start to kind of deviate from the transactional piece of the equation, it starts to get a little wonky. So if you say, first of all, hey, how are you doing? The robot immediately gets tripped
up. You try and be nice to the robot.
Being nice to the robot does not work.
They just want your information.
Unusual orders, if you want two top buns or two bottom buns, can kind of throw the robot off as well.
Wait, would people do that?
Yeah, so that's what they said. I was going to say,
like, no pickles. That would be, like, what I do on my orders. People order two top buns?
That's right. So this startup was, you know, kind of collecting all this data, getting all this information on kinds of, you know, unusual orders, and that one would come up, and it would really trip up the robot.
Catherine, you order anything unusual at McDonald's?
Well, so not me, but actually my sister, who's a vegetarian, she has ordered, like, a quarter pounder with no meat. And, you know, the drive-thru person's like, what? Like, why would you want that, you know? But she's a vegetarian, and that's her option at McDonald's.
That will just literally make the robot explode. Yeah. So don't do that. All right, let's jump into Forager, Catherine. This is a logistics company. Actually, I'm going to put you on the spot. I have never understood what a logistics company is. Because there's Coyote Logistics, which you mentioned in this story.
Right.
And I just am always like, I don't know. I imagine it's, what, connecting points on dots and moving, delivering things around?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Pretty simple like that. So, you know, shipping things, and that could be, you know, a variety of things. That's our food. That's, you know, freight. That's whatever it needs to be.
People that need creative solutions to maybe more unique products that they're moving across the country.
Exactly.
Okay.
A lot of the tech companies that we're seeing in the logistics space are simplifying this process so that things can get to their destinations quicker.
Yeah, all right.
So that's basically what Forager's doing. And they raised $3.25 million last week, which is why they were in the news. And, you know, basically what they do is they specialize in international shipping, so primarily to Mexico and Canada. They started out kind of in the automotive and aerospace industries, but have expanded, and now they're shipping tequila and produce and some paper products as well. So,
hey, you know how to get me on board. $3.25 million, that seems like a lot to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a Series A or a seed round, so, you know, a pretty good start for them, and we'll just see how they use it to expand.
And this is, they're coming from some of the Coyote Logistics family, right? The ones that are creating this one.
That's right. So Matt Silver is the son of Jeff Silver,
right,
who's the founder of Coyote Logistics.
All right, there you go. Okay, skincare, obviously important for women, important for men too. Oars and Alps was a Chicago startup that makes skincare products for men, but they've been acquired, right, Jim?
That's right. So we reported last week that Oars and Alps was purchased by SC Johnson. So pretty big name acquisition here in Chicago. And Oars and Alps is a really interesting startup, founded just 3 years ago by two women, actually. So two women making a men's skincare product. But, you know, they realized that for their husbands, there was just really no kind of healthy products available for them. So what they make is kind of toxin-free, all-natural men's skincare. So everything from kind of body wash to deodorant to facial scrubs. And so they were acquired for about $20 million. Really, you know, an interesting exit. They only raised about $1 million in venture capital funding, only had about less than 10 employees. So, you know, we kind of tend to not really talk about these kind of like mid-level startup acquisitions. You know, we usually talk about a startup when it shuts down or raises, you know, gets acquired for $100 million.
Yes, right.
But there's something wrong with just a really sweet $20 million tech acquisition, especially by a company that's going to kind of continue to help fund you and keep you kind of within their portfolio of products. And SC Johnson, obviously, the behind brands like Ziploc and Windex and Raid. And so pretty interesting acquisition from a pretty neat founding team.
You guys are in this world of innovators and entrepreneurs. Do people often set out to create something that they hope gets bought by someone else? Does anyone go in with that in mind, or do you hope to take over and be a disruptor and change the whole game plan?
Well, the conversation starts to change once you take venture capital. So once you're taking on outside investment, the idea is that there will be an exit down the road. So mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, when you decide to do that, there's actually kind of a few different philosophies behind that. I mean, some investors want to know what is your plan for an exit, but a lot of other investors specifically don't want you to think we want you to build a business, and then when the right time comes to either sell or to, you know, if you get big enough to go public, mm-hmm. I mean, that can be there as well. But that really is on the mind of a lot of founders, especially once you start bringing in outside capital.
Is Oars and Elves going to keep their brand name then?
They are. So yeah, that looks like the plan, that they're going to kind of continue to be a standalone brand. And it's really interesting. I mean, they've kind of created in the last 3 years a brand that's kind of created this quote unquote cult following with men, because there just really isn't a lot of alternatives out there. And so they've gotten into a big partnership for them is Target. So they're in over 500 Targets around the country. And so being able to kind of not only just have that e-commerce presence, but that physical retail presence is big for a brand like that.
Are either of you guys craft beer people by any chance?
Yes.
Yeah. So I love craft beer, but I'm always seeing new, some of these local places, these breweries get sold obviously to bigger ones. And I think it always eats a little part of your soul away when that happens, because you're like, oh, they had that independence, but talk to the brewers and they're happy and then they get to retire.
I know. Yeah. And you know, it should be a win, right? Like, you think that way with breweries all the time, like, oh, my little corner brewery got, you know, bought by the big guy. But I mean, that's a win for the founders. That means that your beer can be around longer potentially. So I think it's a win in the same sense for the startup world.
Yep. All right. So last one we're going to talk about really quickly is a Chicago startup building a landing spot for at-home drone deliveries. It's got a big week, had a big week down in Georgia, right?
That's right. So Valkyrie is this startup in Chicago, and what they've created is a drone mailbox. And I think when we think about drone deliveries, whether it's from Amazon or Uber or any other kind of company, we think about the process of it, but we mm-hmm. don't really think about the landing area. And everybody's apartment is different. Everybody's home is different. So, you know, creating kind of like a universal landing spot is really fascinating to me. And that's exactly what Valkyrie has done. So they've created basically a mailbox that will accept any kind of drone delivery. And we covered them a little while ago, and just last week, they kind of got their very first kind of public debut in a smart city initiative and down in Atlanta, partnering with Sprint, who kind of powered the 5G that will kind of connect the drone deliveries. And so they're basically creating two types of receptacles, one that'll be traditional, like a suburban mailbox, mm-hmm. and one that will kind of be mounted up on a condo or apartment building, almost like an air conditioning unit.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the landing, because that's fascinating, because imagine that it's got to drop something inside of something, and you want that to not be something that anyone else can open up on the street. So there's just a lot of logistics that must go into locking these mechanisms, making sure that they can accept multiple different kinds of drones. Right, Catherine?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, nobody has, you know, really thought about this. Like, the drone conversation has been going on for a long time. But if you're expecting an important package, if you're expecting a meal, right, mm-hmm. You don't want it to get taken. You want it to be somewhere safe, sheltered from the weather, perhaps. You know, there's a lot of cases where something like this will be useful.
I just assume they'd take the Santa route and just drop everything down the chimney. It seems like the easiest way to do it. All right, Jim and Catherine, where can people find out more information about all you guys do?
Check us out at chicagono.com and sign up for our daily newsletter, The Beat.
All right, have a good one, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kleppen. 12:39 on this Monday afternoon. Still foggy downtown. Low clouds here. Eventually, we're supposed to get some sun and a warm week ahead, as you just heard Don mention. Big news over the weekend, Purdue Pharma, the makers of the highly addictive painkiller OxyContin, they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy this yesterday, part of an agreement. They're settling a bunch of lawsuits across a lot of states, though not all of them. It's a $10 billion settlement, and it's expected to break up the company. Here to break down more of that is from the Washington Post, Christopher Rowland. Chris, thanks for joining us here today.
Oh, sure. How you doing?
Have I got all those details right? $10 billion, and as part of it, it's expected to break up the company, right?
Right. And the $10 billion is a little bit misleading. It's under dispute. The family that owns Purdue Pharma, the Sackler family, has agreed to sell some of its international holdings and pony up about $3 billion in cash. And that's really the core nut of the cash flow of this settlement. Then the rest of the company, that's the shell of Purdue Pharma, over the next 10 years, whatever it's worth, could be, you know, a few billion. And then they're going to, they have a novel idea of continuing to sell OxyContin to finance free giveaways of rescue drugs like Narcan and things like that. It's, you know, the $10 million is a little bit misleading, but ultimately the company will go away in its current form.
The Sackler family giving up $3 billion, some people might hear that and say, oh, well, good, they deserve to do that, and that's certainly your opinion to have that. It's interesting, though, that they're worth somewhere of $15 billion, and some people have alleged that really over the last 10 or so years they've been kind of doing their best way of trying to, I don't want to say hide the money, but funnel it back into their pockets, anticipating this exact sort of thing to happen.
Yeah, and that's exactly what's going to be in dispute before the bankruptcy court and a number of different state courts. So as you pointed out in your intro, a number of states have not signed on to this big mega settlement, and it's about half the states. And the reason they haven't is that they believe that the Sacklers are not ponying up enough cash, and that indeed the allegation is that you know, from 2008 to 2018 or so, the Sacklers pulled out as much as $11 billion out of Purdue Pharma to protect it from litigation. And so that, compared to $11 billion, the $3 billion that they've offered seems low to these states. So there's going to be this big effort to figure out where that money is, how much of it can be clawed back, and whether or not a bankruptcy judge will approve such clawbacks. That's really going to be the dramatic focal point over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I imagine the worry for some states, and maybe why they did settle, is maybe you end up getting a ruling that's more. But if you drag this through courts for 5-10 years, who knows how long, that the legal costs are just going to, you know, kind of take away anything that you might have earned more.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, the company says that it's already spent $250 million in legal fees this year alone in the first three quarters. And, you know, so, and a lot of states are looking at that and saying, those states that did sign on to the settlement and all the, up to 2,000 counties and cities around the country involved in this massive litigation are like, let's just take this deal and, you know, not worry about, right, over the next 10 years, who knows what could be left, and it could be fighting over a tiny shell anyway, so let's take the $3 billion and call it a day.
Chris writes for the Washington Post, and I'm reading your article, and in the second graph you had a really interesting nugget to lead off with, that the filing expected to lead to the ultimate demise of a company that sold a fraction of the opioid prescriptions, but nonetheless is most closely identified with the epidemic. Could you dive in there a little bit more on exactly what you mean by that?
Yeah, so when OxyContin came on the market in 1996, it was a novel product with its extended time release formula, and Purdue Pharma spent millions and millions of dollars marketing it, and it turns out it was misleading marketing, saying that it was safe. Mm-hmm. Because of the extended release, and that it would not have the low chance of addiction was extremely low. Well, that turned out to be just not true, and it led, according to many lawsuits and attorneys general across the country, it really sparked the opioid epidemic. So ultimately, once generics came in and a lot of other drugs were sold, the actual OxyContin pills were eclipsed by all these other drugs, but by then the damage had been done. Many people were addicted, and the drugs just flowed across the landscape, and started. And also, I might add that some people say that it led to ultimately what's now the most lethal overdoses now is in heroin and fentanyl.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that they had gone to court once and already settled. What, like 10 years ago or so?
Yeah, in 2007, Purdue Pharma and three executives pleaded guilty to criminal charges of misrepresenting the drug and deceitful marketing, saying that it was safe when it was not. And so, but that's what's another crazy twist in this story is that a year later, Purdue Pharma started massively enhancing its sales budget and boosted OxyContin sales again through up to their highest levels ever, reaching up over $3 billion. A year in a couple of those peak years. So they went right back to it, and that's another point, a major point of allegation in all the litigation that's going on right now.
Yeah, it's crazy. I also wanted to ask about this $10 billion once it goes through, if it goes through, I should say. Is this going to consumers, people that have suffered? Is this going to municipalities that have had to deal with the crisis?
Well, so it will remain to be seen how exactly the $3 billion in cash from the sale of certain Sackler-held assets would be distributed, but that would be money that would be made available, yes, through, you know, and they'll have to come up with some kind of formula. Then the really novel and interesting thing about this is that what they're proposing is that the company become a public trust, and that it would be, its main function would be to produce rescue drugs that, like the nasal antidote for overdosing and things like that, that and also drugs that could treat opioid addiction, and they would distribute those to counties across the country, especially the hardest hit counties, for free. So they're trying to turn this company that's been really, you know, demonized in the public mind for the last 10 years, they're trying to turn it into a force of public good. It's very interesting.
Do we know, that is interesting, do we know anything else in terms of what comes next in this process, date-wise?
Well, there's going to be motions. So, you know, the states that did not sign on to the settlement are going to be heading into bankruptcy court with motions to try to make sure that their point of view is heard. It's a complicated situation where you have a bunch of plaintiffs are want to settle, but then a bunch of very powerful states, yeah, including, you know, New York and California, some of the biggest states in the country, are saying we're not going to settle. So that's going to be really where the friction point comes up. And so in the coming weeks, you'll see that those legal battles playing out.
I'm a little embarrassed. I don't know, did Illinois settle or not? I didn't read into the story. I don't mean to put you on the spot here.
You know, I don't know either.
Tell you what, I'll find out during the commercial break and update everyone on that. I'm sure you've got it in the list somewhere, Chris, but not didn't prep you there on the notes.
It did go along. Democratic states tended not to settle.
All right. Chris Rowland, thanks so much for breaking this down for us. We appreciate it.
Sure thing. Happy to do it.
Yep. Now time for the Wintrust Business Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. The Nestle Food and Candy Company may be sweet, but their recent announcement of the closing of their Glendale Heights distribution center isn't. This comes after a business decision to move the store-owned distribution center to a third-party company. As a result, the company will lay off 121 workers between October 18th and the end of this year. But maybe with a little time off, some of those former workers might enjoy a nice sporting match or two, possibly a Chicago Fire game, and they might notice some new things that come with the new ownership. Joe Mansueto, founder of Chicago-based financial services company Morningstar, officially has full ownership of the Chicago Fire. He dipped his toe into the sports biz last year after buying a 49% stake in the team and purchased them outright this year after the former ownership's contract ended. The franchise is valued at $245 million, and if Joe sees that as a good value, he must see some sort of increase on the horizon. How cool would that be, though? Own a sports team? Hello, sir. Welcome to the game. Ticket, please.
I don't have one, but here's my receipt. I own the team. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Wintrust Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon. By the way, one of my favorite things to do is to read the text line and see what people are texting Bill and Wendy and read random ones. Here's one. I got kicked in the face by a deer at the deer park in Wisconsin Dells. Amy Guth, I don't know what they're talking about, but it sounds like fun.
My favorite thing is to look at out-of-context text messages for other hosts, because you're like, I wonder what that means.
Yeah, Nick D should do that now on Friday mornings. Out-of-context text as well.
Free idea from Guth and Hanson.
Exactly. Well, I don't know about free. All right, host of the Cranes Daily Gist, Amy, we're talking about United Expedia. Happy for everyone, right? Because they're going to still be able to buy United tickets, it looks like, on Expedia.
Yeah, this has been a standoff between the two where United said, you know what, we're going to go like Southwest, and you can only find our fares on our site. Get out of here with all those things. And so, yeah, the standoff has come to an end, and so that deal was announced today, ending said standoff. So they're not going to take their, you know, their tickets off of those kind of search platforms. But this is a really interesting topic that extends to like meal delivery and a lot of other things, because sometimes you don't know what site you're on. And there was a thing we talked about on the Business Lunch a couple of Saturdays ago about how a lot of these travel sites are all owned by the same person.
Right.
So you might think, okay, I'm going to look at Orbitz and Kayak and Travelocity and Priceline. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. They're
it's all
owned
the same.
By the same thing.
It doesn't matter. And so sometimes you think you're going to another site.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it really points to this moment in which we're doing a lot of commerce online to order our food, to travel to the places we need to go. It's hard to tell who owns what, and it's kind of hard for consumers to follow that paper trail and, you know, decide who you're supporting and all that stuff.
I've done hotels. I've done hotels on hotels.com. Although recently I've started just calling the hotel directly. They sometimes get you a better rate. I use Grubhub all the time. I've never bought a flight using one of these things. And I don't know if it's just because of the, it feels like there's a higher burden of, like, flight seems so important. Like,
that's right.
Going to the airline. I just don't trust these third-party sites.
I did it. I used to do it all the time until one time it was bad weather and a flight got bumped. And at the ticket counter, they're like, you got to call Expedia or whoever it was. And like getting through to them when everybody had just gotten bumped because of this blizzard was a nightmare.
So they can't, they don't help you at the gate.
Yeah. I was like, okay, from now on, I am only going to book with the airline
right.
directly and like keep it real. Yeah. So it's an interesting moment where we're using all, you know, technology is great and it makes it easy to look for deals and things like that. And that's totally good. And I know there's tons of people that fill in Instagram with the beautiful results of right. traveling cheaply.
Right.
But it's like it's a contentious point for airlines in terms of keeping their revenue and keeping it all together and all
that. Do we have any idea how much they get out of each booking? I'm sure they don't ever publicly list it. But I mean, obviously they're losing a little revenue on the front end, but the idea is of course they get that much more exposure
That's
to
right.
their rates.
And my guess is we're about to see a lot more tension in the airlines because of Boeing being grounded. That's changed the bottom line for a lot of airlines. United has talked about that, Delta has talked about that, American has talked about that. So we have airlines trying to recoup the costs of like, hey, 30 planes were grounded.
Right.
Now my plan to expand seats and make them bigger, I can't do that now. I got to do something else. So
right.
we're entering an interesting, this holiday travel season will be really fascinating.
All right, Guth, where can people find out more about the Daily Gist and all that you do?
You know, every day, the best way to find out is to subscribe on Spotify or iTunes or subscribe to one of the Crane's newsletters. There's an afternoon update that's great that keeps you in the know with all the business headlines you need. And there's always a link to it.
Great stuff, Amy. Thanks so much.